Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this week's show because we are celebrating the 20th anniversary of one of the best movies of 1997, Jackie Brown, and I'm joined for this very special episode by Adam Riske.
Bromley's got a brand new bag.
I like what you did there.
Yeah.
I do. Sort of by chance and sort of by design, we've done a lot of 1997 movies this year, especially early on. Just kind of turned out that we were doing a bunch of 97, so we're going to keep that train going.
Do you think, in hindsight, that 97 was a good year for movies?
I think it was an excellent year for movies.
I think so, too.
Yeah, I've thought that forever, pretty much.
And not just like the award season indie stuff, like everything was good throughout the year. It was an interesting time for blockbusters. And some of it's coming back, which I'll get into a little later.
Okay.
I feel like there's movies coming out where I'm like, this should have come out in 1997.
Better than 2000 or 2001, which is what everything feels like.
Yeah, I took a try at a 2017, what would my list be? And I'll put 97 heads and tails over 2017.
Yeah. 98 was like okay, and then 99 came screaming back because 99 was like one of the best years ever.
Yeah, it's going to be a challenge to find 20 years later candidates for 1998, I want to do like Star Kid.
You could do Star Kid.
Joseph Madman
Mazzello. A Simple Plan. Are people still talking about that one?
Or Star Kid.
Star Kid is so we're going to be talking about Jackie Brown a little bit later, but first, Adam Riske, let me ask you, if I sound a little bit off my game, I apologize. I've been a little bit sick this weekend.
I'll carry you past the goal line.
Thank you so much. Have you seen anything good lately?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of stuff because after Scary Movie Month ended, I really enjoyed Scary Movie Month. It was great.
Yeah.
But it was, as we've said before, it's refreshing to change genres.
Right.
Because I think I only watched like Blade Runner 2049 and The Foreigner in October. And those were like the only non-horror movies
that
I watched.
The Foreigner?
It's weird because, like, it feels like it should have been made in 1997.
I got it.
Okay. And I didn't even mean to bring that up, but I didn't want to talk about The Foreigner. But it's weird because, like, Jackie Chan
is
on the poster. He's predominantly in the ads.
Yeah.
But this is really more like Pierce Brosnan's movie.
What's the opposite of one, please?
Hold on. I'll get you back. Did you know that there's a heavy IRA subplot?
One, please?
Yeah.
So this is the spiritual sequel to 1997's The Devil's Own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I need that money, Tom.
Jackie Chan's just like, I'm not going back, Tom.
I was baptized in it.
I rewatched that.
You wrote a thing on it. It is a fucking dumb movie.
It's not
that
a
I
good
do
movie.
Not like.
Yeah, it's not too good. But I saw The Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Okay.
Did you see that yet?
Not yet. Okay. I have a copy of it that I really want to watch, but I was not in the mood last night.
Okay. So I'm not a fan of The Lobster. I've never seen Dogtooth.
Okay.
I forgot what the director's name is.
Yorgos Lanthimos or something.
Yeah, thank
like
you.
That?
I don't want to mispronounce it.
Sure.
I kind of knew what it was.
Oh, you just were setting me up to fail.
Thank you.
I see what it is.
You're welcome. but I saw it like it was a double feature that I did with The Florida Project.
Okay.
And The Florida Project was first, and that movie's amazing. It will be in my top 10, and it's devastating. And then The Killing of a Sacred Deer is like, I think it's supposed to be devastating, but I was by myself in a theater watching it at like 10 o'clock at night.
Mm.
And after The Florida Project, I wasn't in the mood for it to push my buttons.
Sure.
So I just kind of like thought everything in it was funny. And I didn't know if I was supposed to think it's funny.
Okay.
But with the director of The Lobster, maybe.
Maybe.
I mean, there's a lot of like obvious black comedy in Killing of a Sacred Deer, but I think it's also meant to be kind of like a Michael Haneke, like shocking type of movie.
Got it.
I didn't really get that, but I had a great time.
Okay.
And Colin Farrell is amazing in it.
Okay.
And Nicole Kidman's great in it. And then the George from Dunkirk.
Sure.
The guy who was on the boat with Mark Rylance.
Okay.
He is one of the three main characters, and he's awesome.
Okay.
It's very like deadpan and just sort of ironic, and it was good. I really liked it.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. And then I watched Four Rooms. again.
Interesting. Yeah. Is this part of your preparation for Jackie Brown?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to do like that bubble period of like 94 to 97 with Tarantino, but Destiny Turns on the Radio is not available anywhere. It seems pretty well buried.
Bummer.
Yeah.
I saw it in theaters, don't worry.
How crowded was it when you went to
see it? I don't think it was very crowded.
Okay. But I watched a lot of interviews with Tarantino, a lot of...
Did you watch his episode of All American Girl?
I did. I've seen it multiple times.
It is wall-to-wall douche chills.
What was his favorite movie of 1994 in All American Girl?
I don't remember.
Ed Wood.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
I can't really argue with that. Yeah.
And it was in a suitcase that glowed.
Oh, I remember the... Oh, boy.
Right. It's kind of weird that a director is just like, yeah, make my thing more annoying, please.
So the last time I watched Four Rooms was years ago.
Yeah.
And it might have been the first time I'd seen it since theaters, when, of course, I went to see it, like, on New Year's Day, like, as soon as I could.
I saw it opening day, too.
Yeah, it was like, Tarantino, right?
Yep.
And at the time, I was positive that Robert Rodriguez's segment was hands down the best one.
Yeah.
But I feel like the last time I rewatched it, I think I liked his way less and Tarantino's more.
Okay.
Am I remembering this wrong?
No, because the time I had watched this previously to this current time, I had the same thought. But now I think the Rodriguez one is still better than the Tarantino one. I think they're both fun.
Yeah.
And they definitely liven things up from like the complete dead weight of the first half.
Which is part of the problem, I think, is that anything is going to seem better by comparison.
Yeah, and I mean, that movie is... I know Tim Roth is doing a Jerry Lewis type thing.
Sometimes.
He's very inconsistent.
Yeah.
Sometimes he's really British and Cockney, and sometimes he's not.
And
sometimes
I think that
Mr.
was
Bean.
My feeling about the Rodriguez one was like, oh, well, he gave Tim Roth something to do, and that's why he's giving a performance in that one.
Yeah, so I enjoyed like the second half of it just as much as I usually do. Mm-hmm. I think it's definitely one of the better things that Robert Rodriguez has made. I didn't realize until I watched it this time that the line, like, I don't have a problem, I have problems, plural, that, like, I got that from Four Rooms.
Oh, wow.
I forgot that. I don't say it, like, all the time, but I probably say it, like, once or twice. 5 years. But I know that I've said it in reference to things. I don't know. I like the music in it. It's really weird. It's like all this weird scatting stuff.
I need to revisit it. I mean, I will always have a weird affection for it, even though it's not good.
Yeah.
Just for what it represents from that period and what a sort of exciting time that was in movies for me as somebody who was starting to discover all that stuff.
I know. I was pumped, too. I went opening day to One Schomburg Place.
Me, too.
We could have been in the same theater.
We very well may have been.
You never know.
Yeah. Mm.
Two ships crossing in the
right.
sea.
That's right.
And then I
was the one masturbating during the Allison Anders segment.
Oh,
do you remember that guy?
A bit.
Okay. Yeah, that was me.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Well, I think that's maybe when I went out to get popcorn.
Yeah, no, you probably might have made the right call there.
I was just like biting the top of my shirt, and I'm like, I have to go.
I like Alison Anders, but that is not a good
sequence. I've never seen any of her feature movies.
You never saw Grace in My Heart?
No, I never saw Gas Food Lodging.
Gas Food Lodging is good. I really like Grace in My Heart.
Yeah.
And I'm sad that she didn't become more of a thing, you know, than she was. I think she does a lot of TV now.
Yeah, I looked at her credits and there was stuff that she has done, but it's not like things that are, you know, real mainstream, I guess. So I watched I knew the Jim and Andy documentary was coming out on Netflix, so I watched that, and I also watched Man on the Moon again, which was first time I'd seen that in maybe
99.
Like 10 years or so. I liked Man on the Moon more than I have before. I think the performance is terrific.
Yeah.
I like Milos Forman's just kind of biography style, his biopic style. Like, because I really like Amadeus, and I really like People versus Larry Flint. And this is not as good as those two, but it's close. And I just find Andy Kaufman, like, as interesting as I do find him frustrating. And I think that's obviously the point. The thing that, but as like somebody who is on a really low level done comedy, I find it interesting because I got to a point where I think you're always kind of like, if you're a comedian, you're always trying to like find that thing that'll set you apart. Like, what's your daring, like your big star thing? What's going to be your quirk?
For me, it's puppets.
I got a few that I could recommend for you. The thing that I kind of noticed as I've gotten older is that it's so much easier and better, I think, for me personally when I'm watching comedy, if the comedian is inclusive, if it's like not really trying to put the joke over on you. Right. It's just like they have confidence in their material, that they just want everybody to have a good time. And maybe that doesn't make them like a quote unquote artiste, but that's what I like. And Andy Kaufman was definitely not that. He was more, you know, like, I want to frustrate the audience, and that's the joke. And like, shame on them if they don't know that. And then sometimes throw them off by being like really kind of inclusive at the same time. Mm-hmm. But it was all part of like this thing. And there's a line in the movie that I really like where it's just like, are you trying to make them laugh, or is this just a joke for you and Bob Zemuda and stuff? And I find that aspect really funny, and or not funny, but interesting. And Jim and Andy was like a really weird experience. Did you watch it?
I'm kind of avoiding it.
Okay.
Because I think it's going to leave a bad taste in my mouth.
It did with me too, because there's a lot of stuff in it that it's all about the behind the scenes of Man on the Moon and how method Jim Carrey went in it. And part of it is, I don't know how much of this is just a gag, like they just shot it and this is almost like a mockumentary type of thing. And I don't like being toyed with in that way. And then if it's, but I almost hope that it is, because if it's true, like what really happened, then some of the stuff that they did in this, like Jim Carrey pretending to be Andy Kaufman and talking to like Andy Kaufman's real life, like daughter that he had given up for adoption as Andy Kaufman for over an hour to have some kind of like a therapy session, is like so extremely distasteful that I don't want any part of it. And it makes me never want to watch anything with Jim Carrey again. And Jim Carrey's the only person interviewed. He's the only talking head. So he tells a lot of it. And he just seems like, he says it's because of partially like he came out of the experience of pretending to be Andy Kaufman full time, a changed person. But let me tell you, I mean, like, he didn't change for the better in my in my opinion, because he is like a creepy, weird, unsettling guy now. And it makes me really second guess that article I wrote about him like a few years ago when I first started on the site, where I'm just like, Jim Carrey's great and underrated and all this stuff. And now I'm just kind of like, no, like, it, I, like 2017 is the year where the veil has come down. And it's just like, oh, everybody that you used to like, did you know that while that was happening, that they are just like, so I mean, and it was a really just icky experience. So it's classic Netflix where it's just like, oh, I'm excited about this. And then I watch it and I'm just like, it's marginal at best or irritating.
When Man on the Moon came out, I was really excited about it. And I really liked it at the time. I haven't revisited it in a long time, but I was super excited about it. And I was reading a lot about Andy Kaufman. There were two books that came out around the same time. Mm-hmm. One was by Bob Zemuda and one was called Lost in the Funhouse. And I read both of them and I was just like way into reading about Andy Kaufman. Not even because I was like such a fan of his comedy. I just was super interested in him. Mm-hmm. And so I was really excited about it. And I just felt like when I read a little bit about this documentary, because, yeah, of course, like, I like that movie. It's on Netflix. It's super accessible. Like, why wouldn't I watch it? But I don't know. Thinking about it, I'm not a big fan of, like, method. However you do it, fine. But, like, all I care about is the end result. Like, I don't – you were great as Andy Kaufman in the movie. I don't care how you got there. And so to spend 2 hours watching you live your life as Andy Kaufman and giving me douche chills, I just felt like – that movie was going to put all this stuff in my head that I didn't want in my head.
Yeah, I kept thinking of like the Jared Leto Joker thing the whole time.
Right,
I'm just like, if that's what he was like on the set, like, there's a lot of actors who don't need to do that.
Exactly.
And I almost feel like maybe they're more talented than you if they don't have to do that. If you could just turn it on. And I mean, I don't think like Meryl Streep is walking around acting like Julia Child the whole time. I mean,
that's That's where you're wrong.
So
it's actually Meryl Streep. That's the performance. Julia Child is her default.
I understand.
Yeah, it's like that Superman Clark Kent monologue from the end of Kill Bill.
Look at that segue. And then I saw Justice League.
Okay.
And
now, before you say anything,
yes,
I had every intention of seeing Justice League this weekend and putting a review up on the site because I know that we'll have some listeners or readers who will feel like we have a Marvel bias.
Yeah.
Because we tend to cover their movies, and we will not have covered Justice League.
Yeah.
So I apologize. The reason I didn't is because I got very sick this weekend and haven't seen Justice League yet. So we're talking about it here, so everyone
relax. Consider it covered.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, there won't be a full review.
I'm going to say all the good stuff first all with right. Justice League. I think that she doesn't have a lot to do. I think they just didn't have enough time.
She's in the movie.
She's in the movie. They didn't have enough time to add more stuff with Wonder Woman.
I'll bet some of the stuff, and I don't know this for sure, but I'll bet some of the stuff that's in the movie
was
already added after Wonder Woman was such a huge hit.
Yeah. It wasn't enough. The good things in the movie is I criticize Justice League I criticize the DC Extended Universe because it's so bleak. Aesthetically, they brightened things up in Justice League. Even from the time where the trailers were coming out, it looks like they did some color correction on things like that. Also good, maybe minor spoiler. If you don't want to know anything, just skip ahead like a minute. Superman is lighter, and that's really refreshing.
Yeah.
So even if it wasn't necessarily great, I was really thrilled that with the direction that they took him in, and I'd be open to them following this path for future movies.
Right.
I thought that it was probably like the third best of the five DC movies. I don't think it's Wonder Woman's still the best. I don't think this is as good as Man of Steel as a movie.
Okay.
Even though it's maybe more fun.
Okay.
It's better than Suicide Squad. It's better than Batman versus Superman. I walked away of it thinking it feels a lot like Batman and Robin or like the 1997 version of a DC Batman movie. Mm-hmm. It's like if they didn't have all their chips kind of pushed in, this would be the one where they're like, maybe we should reset everything. because it's, I mean, like I definitely struggled to stay interested throughout it. The plot is not there. The villain is the thing I'll never understand is you got formidable villains in these standalone superhero movies, but it's always like the one where you have to form the super group. They've got like a villain where you would think like any one of them individually could have taken them down. And that's so true with Steppenwolf in this, which is like a motion capture performance similar to the big orc guy in the Hobbit movies. And it's just, it doesn't work, and I don't know. I mean, the humor is there. It's not really funny. It's just, it's kind of just more like, you know, amiable, I guess. Okay. So I didn't hate it, but I wouldn't really recommend it either. So I saw that, and then I got two more. I saw a double feature yesterday of Three Billboards outside Ebbings, Missouri.
Okay.
I was disappointed by it.
Okay.
I know a lot of people really like it. I think it has a lot of script problems. Characters kind of like going up and down in like level of intelligence that kind of threw me off.
Okay.
And I feel like Frances McDormand, who I like as an actress, is kind of doing like an Erin Brockovich blindside thing.
Okay.
Where she's just kind of the sassy one. And I didn't really believe that she kind of like the reason why she was supposed to be this way. I feel like the movie deals with things like rape and racism in a very kind of trivial way that upset me,
okay,
to be honest. So I know a lot of people like it. I'm in the minority on it. I just was pretty disappointed. But then after that, I saw Lady Bird, and Lady Bird is wonderful. And it reminded me a lot of, at times, of like Clueless and especially of Juno, where it's very funny, but it's super sweet. And it's just a real surprise because, like, even the closest movie I could maybe compare it to is like a Frances Ha thing because it's written directed by Greta Gerwig. And Saoirse Ronan is amazing in it, and you can definitely tell she's kind of playing Greta Gerwig in a way. But it's very charming. It's almost like I would rather have Saoirse Ronan play Greta Gerwig than see Greta Gerwig play her be herself in a movie. But now it's like, because Frances Ha is like maybe the post-collegiate Gerwig, and then Lady Bird is like the high school Gerwig. I feel like I need to see like the pre-high school Gerwig years. Like it's like my 7-Up series. So I don't know. I like the
young Sheldon of Greta Gerwig.
Exactly. Yeah, but it's great. It's a really wonderful movie.
I can't wait to see it. Yeah. I wish I had seen it already.
Yeah.
But it's not playing super close. It's not super far, I know.
Like, they're expanding it because it's doing pretty well. So yeah. I know it's like in Lincolnshire and stuff like that.
So I'm definitely going to see it because I've heard nothing but great things and I'm very excited.
Yeah.
I don't have anything as exciting as you because everything I've been seeing is like older. Like, the first one I'll talk about is really old, not really old, but like, it's not a 2017 movie. I've been doing this thing in part because I've been listening to a lot of 80s All Over, which I've been hearing about so much, but just never listened to. And I like it a lot because they talk about a lot of movies, and that's I like that because they just list a bunch of titles and put stuff on my radar. And they had mentioned Victor Victoria,
okay,
which I grew up with an awareness of but have never seen. And it's part of what I'm going to start calling my TV guide movies because when I was a kid, when I was probably 6 or 7, we didn't have cable, but we would get the TV guide. And in the back of the TV guide was essentially this is like the real TV guide. This isn't like the one that came in the newspaper. There was an alphabetical listing of every movie that was on that month on one of the pay channels or whatever. And that's what I would do. I would just study the back of this little alphabetical listing. And all it did was give, you know, the runtime and a little 2-sentence plot summary and maybe a few cast members. It wasn't a review or anything. And so there's all these movies that have existed in my head for 35 years based on just studying the back of this TV guide. And Victor Victoria is a total TV guide movie. So I tracked it down from our public library and finally watched it and was really blown away by it.
Good. Who's in it? Julie Andrews?
Julie Andrews, James Garner,
okay.
Robert Preston, Alex Karras, Leslie Ann Warren. Like, whoa.
Hi.
Yeah. I would never say that I'm like a huge Blake Edwards fan. Everything I've seen of Blake Edwards has been like, that was okay, or I didn't care for that at all.
Sure.
I recently saw SOB for the first time, was not a fan. You know, this was his first, outside of like some of the Pink Panther movies, this was his first movie that I was like, holy shit, that is really, really terrific. And so ahead of its time because I was watching another movie last night, which I'll get to in 1 second, that tried to deal with a lot of the same stuff. And I was like, yeah, but this movie was made in 2017 and Victor Victoria was made in 1982 and was saying some things about gender identity and homosexuality that, like, I think for the most part, most of us thinking people are on board with in 2017, but in 82, that was not the case. So check it out. There's a Warner Archive Blu-ray of it floating around somewhere, but it's really, really good and a really gorgeous use of widescreen, which is one of the things that I like about Blake Edwards. And then last night I saw Battle of the Sexes, which you had written about in your catch-up column. And then, so that was the movie that's kind of dealing with some of the same stuff.
I loved on Facebook how you wrote that. I was like, I fill in the cracks because I'm a total crackhead. That made me laugh out loud. So this is one of the times I did crack.
So this is kind of dealing with the same thing where it's talking, you know, how do we talk about same-sex couples and homosexuality? In this case, in 1973, but they're talking about it in 2017 terms, you know, the way that Victor Victoria is in 1982, but talking about it from the 1930s. Here's the thing. I was entertained throughout Battle of the Sexes. I liked it. I don't know that it's like that good of a movie.
Yeah, I felt similar.
But I don't have any like major objections to it. Like, the filmmaking is fine.
Yeah.
And in some cases, good. Like, I didn't realize until about halfway through that it was the Little Miss Sunshine people. And I think the filmmaking is a little better than Little Miss Sunshine, although I haven't seen Little Miss Sunshine since, what, 2007?
Six.
2006.
Unless you watched it in 7. You could have.
I don't think that was my big Little Miss Sunshine year.
Okay.
And the cast is great. Like, every person who shows up, even for a small part, is like someone that you're happy to see.
Yeah, like a lot of overqualified actors playing really tiny roles.
It's bananas, right? Yeah. Like Bill Pullman,
John C. McGinley as like the drunk friend of Steve Carell.
Eric Christian Olsen, who's really funny.
Yeah,
who's basically just like, hey, let's.
Was he Steve Carell's son?
He was his coach.
Oh, okay,
yeah. Okay. His son wasn't anybody that I recognized.
Yeah, I just couldn't remember.
But, like, Bill Pullman is in it quite a bit.
Yeah.
And there's a couple scenes of Bill Pullman just, like, sitting in a chair. And there's a guy next to Bill Pullman. And that's Tom Kenny from Mr. Show.
Mm-hmm.
And he's hilarious. He was the voice of SpongeBob or whatever. But, like, how does Tom Kenny end up in this movie and given nothing to do?
Yeah.
But whatever, right?
I thought that, like, the guy who... He was in Bridge of Spies and Whiplash, but he plays Billie Jean King's husband in Battle of the Sexes. I thought his stuff was the most interesting part of the movie for whatever reason.
Sure.
And the whole time I'm watching it, I'm just kind of like, is this a sign like that they didn't have great control over their material or they're trying to tell too many stories?
They're trying to tell too many
stories. Like, if the thing I'm latching onto is not the major message of the movie, but instead, like, I feel really bad for this guy and what a trooper he is.
Well, because for so much of the movie, and I guess spoilers for real life coming up. For so much of the movie, you feel like he's just sort of put upon, or not in a bad way, but he's just a little bit of a dupe, and like he kind of knows what's going on, but he's going to be the nice guy or whatever. But then you get to the end, and he says, like, is there anyone you want me to call?
Mm-hmm.
And the little postscript at the end, which is like they split up because essentially Billie Jean King eventually came out as gay and had a relationship for a long time with a woman, and her husband remarried, and Billie Jean King and her partner were the godparents to his kids. Yeah. And like that, it's such a little beautiful story that it almost made me appreciate his whole arc in the movie more because of like that little postscript for real life. You're like, oh, this is actually this beautiful little story of these two people.
Yeah.
Cause
it's like, this was never about you. This was just how I am. And we don't have to be bitter because society says we have to be bitter.
Right.
Yeah.
So, like, the tennis stuff was kind of interesting on its own.
I think it works as a sports movie pretty well.
Yeah. Like, the game I thought was pretty cool at the end. Yeah. And I really liked Emma Stone. I thought she was really good.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Carell was fun. You know, I was watching it with Erica, and she was like, oh, my God, is he really saying this? I was like, I think he's, like, playing a part of, like, a pro wrestler would, you know? Just a guy. Right.
He's the heel. Yeah.
Exactly. Whether or not that guy actually believed that, I couldn't say. But, like, in terms of the interviews he was giving and stuff, it was almost half joking.
Yeah.
But it's trying to do too much, and so much attention is paid. Like, it wants to just be a straightforward biopic of Billie Jean King. And then it's like, oh, wait, we have to remember that we're telling these two stories because we're also talking about, I keep on and calling Bobby Fischer, but I know that's not
Bobby
his
Riggs.
Name. Bobby Riggs.
Yeah.
We're also telling the Bobby Riggs story, so we got to shoehorn some gambling and Elizabeth Shue in here, which, listen, I'm not complaining.
It's almost like unfortunate that both of these things happened at the same time.
Right.
Because otherwise they would have had a clear path of like one movie or the other.
So they give so much time over to Billie Jean King's relationship with this hairdresser.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's bad, but it's like, the movie just can't quite decide what it is or what it's trying to say.
This was one of those cases where I was surprised they didn't do like a composite situation where the woman, Andrea Riseborough, or is it Risenborough?
I think it's Riseborough.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was playing. She's not Billie Jean King's partner in real life, like longtime partner.
Right.
It was just, this was her first relationship with a woman. And I almost thought like it would have like been a composite situation where they like just said, oh, well, this was the person that she ended up with. Because otherwise it's just like, oh, she was, it's just because it was the first. It's not because of who it was. So it's almost like nullifies her character a little bit.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that because I think then it becomes like just this story of true love as opposed to her realizing that she identifies as a gay person. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I see what you're saying.
It matters that it's a woman in this instance more than who it is.
So what you're saying is you hate true love.
Yeah, well,
okay,
for sure.
Just wanted to
have
get
I
that
not
out
made
there.
That clear just in wanted, 7 years of this podcast?
I just want let me tell you, you will hate Jackie Brown.
Oh, right? So it's weird because the movie made no impact. Like,
yeah.
Not talked about. Erica was watching and she said, do you think Emma Stone will get nominated? I said, no, She said, why not? Because she just won. I said, no, actually, I think it's because this movie just came and went. I mean, no one is talking about it at all.
Yeah, I think it's weird because there's all these times of the year where it's just barren.
Right.
And then you put out Battle of the Sexes, like, with four other adult dramas,
right,
like, in the same weekend in September. It's like, right, of course it's going to get lost, especially if you're, like, expanding it.
Right.
So
it's, like, okay to decent. It's not great, but, you know, I had a fine time watching it. I was happy with it. And then I watched Good Time.
I haven't seen that yet.
All right.
I know a lot of people like it.
People love it.
Yeah.
I think I didn't connect with it, really. Mm-hmm. I appreciate what it's trying to do. It's very much sort of an After Hours without the comedy, but it all kind of takes place in one night, mm-hmm, and it just keeps unfolding in these weird directions. Robert Pattinson is good. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great, like, demo reel for these two directors.
Yeah.
Like, I think it is going to get them more work, because I think it's well made, and I think it moves in a certain way, and the music is really kind of pulsing, and, like, so it's put together well. It just wasn't for me, you know.
Were you getting, like, frustrated during it, and you're like, Good Time, more like Tood Gime? Right. That's how I was during Three Billboards. I'm like, more like Shmree Shmrill Shmords.
I lost patience with it about halfway through, and I was like, all right, you can begin wrapping up. Like, I feel like that's fair if you give yourself half the movie to be like, all right, now you got to start going somewhere. Now you got to, you know, win me over. And it never quite did. And again, a lot of people are really loving it, so it's not the movie's fault. Obviously, it's mine, but I think it's impressively made and a movie that I will never watch again.
Okay. Side question for you real quick. I had this thing. I was wondering if this ever happens to you. When I was watching Lady Bird, it's like...
More like Beatty Lord.
More like capitalized Lady Bird, because it's awesome. I'm like, when's she going to marry LBJ? I was really confused by that.
Yeah.
So anyways, it was one of those movies where, like, the first half hour is, like, so up my alley. I loved it. In the rest of the movie, I'm just like, oh my God, I want this to be over. It's like running out the clock when you have the lead.
Right.
It's just like, do you ever have that when you're watching?
Oh, sure. You don't want it to break the spell. You don't want it to blow it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I become most aware of it a lot of times during a last shot.
Yeah.
Where it'll be holding on an image and I'll say, okay, please end there. Please end there. Please
I do
end
that
there.
Too. Yeah.
And then it doesn't and I get angry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all like, it's like the emotional height of the movie. It's just like, and that's why I love you. And then it'll be like fade out and like a park. And it's just like,
who wants
Vienna sausages? And then it's just like, do it your thing. Do what you want to do.
And then three post-credit scenes. And you're like, come on.
Yeah.
What a weird way to end Justice League.
With just like with chopsticks, more like schmop schmicks. I can't even hold them. Where's my fork and my agent?
All right, so let's talk Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
To celebrate its 20th anniversary.
Yeah.
Here's the thing about Jackie Brown. Like, you're probably going to hear nothing but gushing over Jackie Brown and deal with it. If you don't like Jackie Brown, I don't know. Maybe this isn't the show for you.
If you don't like Jackie Brown, keep watching Jackie Brown.
I understand not loving Tarantino.
Yeah.
Fine. But, like, Jackie Brown is not the typical Tarantino. And I think if he made this movie in 2017, everyone would be losing their shit over it and saying,
yeah,
oh, it's his best movie by far.
Yeah.
I think it suffered in 1997 by being a significant departure from what he had done before.
Yes.
I think now people have come around on it, and there's lots of people who will say, oh, it's definitely his best movie. But I think in 97, it got a little bit of blowback because it wasn't Pulp Fiction.
And yeah.
Everything he's done since has been closer to Pulp Fiction than Jackie Brown.
Yes. A lot of directors, but a lot, especially Tarantino, is almost like the victim of not doing what he did before. Like, people are like, you're stretching? I don't know. And I mean, I'll be completely honest. Like, this movie came out Christmas Day 97. I was 15. I saw it opening day.
Me too.
My sister and I were.
What theater,
like,
were you at? Were we at
Town
the same
and Country
again? Okay. No, I was at Rolling Meadows with my sister.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Like, my sister and I were just kind of, especially like in the early 90s, like, really shared our kind of, you know, fandom of Quentin Tarantino. So we would always go, we went to see like this together, and then we saw like the Kill Bill movies together, and just all throughout the line. So I was one of those people who was kind of not disappointed, because I liked it. I just thought that I was going to fall head over heels with it, like I did with Pulp Fiction.
Sure.
And a lot of it had to do with, this is a movie about men and women in their 40s or older, and I was 15 years old, and I didn't have the emotional wherewithal to really kind of get it as much as I do when I got older. And I think that also Tarantino's movies are such kind of rich experiences that, yeah, like I've had it with Jackie Brown, I had it with Kill Bill Volume 2 and with Django Unchained and Hateful Eight, where the first time I watch it, they're like 3.5-star movies, and they don't become 4-star movies for me until I see them again. Mm-hmm. Like there's always something where I'm just kind of like, well, it didn't immediately grab me.
Right.
And
right. I definitely had that with Django.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely had that with Hateful Eight even, mm-hmm, too. And then I didn't go back to Jackie Brown for a long time after I saw it. So I saw it opening day, and then I don't think I fell in love with it until it came out on DVD. It came out, I remember, in 2002 on DVD.
Yeah, it took a weirdly long time to come out on DVD.
Yeah, it was like this Vista series, yeah, like, you know, special edition type of DVD. It came out the same day as the Vista series for Pulp Fiction, yeah, which is one of the coolest DVDs ever because it has the Jackrabbit Slim's menu in it. It was a great DVD. And that's when I kind of like finally had it click for me. And then I also remember a couple years prior to that, I was sort of like really open to watching Jackie Brown again, because when I worked at Blockbuster, I remember there was this one couple that came in and they rented Jackie Brown, and I recognized them, and they had rented Jackie Brown from me even like one or two times before. And I said, oh man, I've been meaning to rewatch this movie. And the wife said about her husband, she says, he watches this movie every night almost for a little bit before we go to bed. And then he's just like, I don't know what it is, I just love it. And then when I started to love the movie, I completely got it. Yeah. It's just like, it's one, yeah, of those movies, yeah, where this cast of characters, you just want to hear them talk, mm-hmm, for the rest of your life.
Yep.
And, yeah, it's definitely just one of those movies that gets better every time I see it. I see more in it every time I see it. This time was a special time for me because I was starting to see other things and think other things that I hadn't thought before, because this is, I'm 35 now, and this is probably the first time I've watched it in my 30s. So, yeah, just, I'm a huge, huge fan of this movie. Love it.
It's insanely great.
Yeah.
It was weird the other night. I was watching it when I was sick, and so I literally had to keep pausing it so I could go throw up and then come, mm-hmm, back and then watch another hour and then leave and throw up again. Almost like clockwork. Not a reflection on the movie. Mm-hmm. Just,
were you eating oranges?
I wish, but no.
Because then it could have been a clockwork
lunch. Oh, I like it.
Of your vomit.
Yeah, it was crazy to, yeah, hear somebody refer to Jackie Brown as a 44-year-old woman, because I was like, oh, when I saw this movie, I was 20,
yeah,
and 44 was such a long ways off, you, yeah, know, and now it's 20 years later, and I'm like, oh, we're practically the same age, me and Jackie Brown.
Sure.
I loved it the first time I saw it, and then in the summer of 98, had to have my appendix taken out. And so I was like recovering from surgery for a few days at my mom's house, like convalescing there. Mm-hmm. And she had gone to the video store to rent me a couple of movies.
Mm-hmm.
I remember The Man in the Iron Mask was one.
How could you not?
Right. I feel like there was another one, but I couldn't tell you what it was. Mm-hmm. The other one that I remember is Jackie Brown. And I literally would watch it and then rewind the tape and, yeah, then watch it again.
Yep.
Because like you said, it's just a movie that you want to hang out with. And the thing that I love about Tarantino, and again, I know not everybody does, because they feel like his movies are too referential or immature, which Jackie Brown is so not,
right,
an immature movie at all. And the fact that this was his third movie blows me away, because this is the work of like a mature adult man.
Like, yeah,
so much so. Anyway, some of that may come from the Elmore Leonard novel, which, mm-hmm, I have not read. the thing that I always love about his movies are the characters. That's mm-hmm. the thing that makes them endure. That's mm-hmm. why I want to keep going back and revisiting his movies, is because I like spending time in the company of his characters. And he has, I think, said as much about his work. And I don't think he's ever had better characters in a movie than Jackie Brown.
I would agree with that. You said a couple of things that I definitely want to touch on. One is just...
Is one of them about my appendix?
I do want to touch your appendix. Do you have
it's
it somewhere?
Not there. You, no, they didn't no, give did it to me. They did not give it to me, which is kind of bullshit.
Do you remember the name of your doctor? was it Giggles?
Oh, no. That's why you kept making those jokes.
Do you remember on the T2 VHS, they had that commercial about, like, where some kid was in the hospital, and then they're just like, oh, you're in for an appendicitis, and he's just like, no, I'm not. I'm in for, like, a dental exam or something. Do you remember that?
No.
Maybe I hallucinated it. I'm sorry I wasted everybody's time.
Somebody listening to this right now is like, I totally remember that.
Yeah, it was just one of those weird VHS ads. The referential thing. Here's the thing. Does he reference other movies? Of course he does. There's a lot of things that he does that references other movies. Two things about that. One is, you don't have to have seen those movies to enjoy what he's referencing.
Not at all.
And it's never been that case, because especially prior to, I don't know, every movie of his that I've seen, I have not seen the movies that he's referencing.
Right.
And I always enjoy what he's doing. Second of which, unlike a lot of directors who do homages to other directors, Tarantino is trying to make a even better movie than they did. Mm-hmm. And not as like a thing where it's a snotty thing. It's just that he's so talented that it's almost like hard not for him to make something even better than those other directors had. So what are you complaining about?
Right.
So that's my thing about the referential thing. The other thing I want to mention is about his characters. I don't mean to play like kind of dime store psychologist, and from watching a lot of the interviews of Tarantino around this time,
I don't mean to interrupt. Yeah. You had mentioned that you were watching a bunch of
like Charlie Rose stuff,
and I wanted to do the same, but then I remembered what he was like around this time, and so I held off.
Okay, there's some interviews where I definitely did hold off, because
When he was on the Ricky Lake show,
he was like definitely playing up the blaxploitation element of it. However, on Charlie Rose, he's like in a blazer wearing like a white turtleneck.
Okay.
And the whole time he's talking a lot about his relationship with Mira Sorvino. And part of the thing, I don't know, I know they dated from like 96 to 98, which I'm guessing was probably around the time where at least he was writing some of Jackie Brown or adapting the novel. It feels like a movie made by a guy who's in love, and that's something that I really like about Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
Or like where a woman is really like influencing him in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like he learned from that.
Mm-hmm.
Because as much as I love Pulp Fiction, it's one of my favorite movies, and as much as I really like Reservoir Dogs too, the jump in characterization and the emotional life mm-hmm. of his characters mm-hmm. in Jackie Brown is so much richer in those mm-hmm. in this movie than it is in those movies, where it's more kind of school of cool. Mm-hmm. That I think that he learned from that, and he implanted that in Kill Bill, and he did that in Django Unchained, and in a lot of movies. Also, I think that, like you had mentioned, there's so much pressure off of Pulp Fiction. Like, whenever you hit it big, like, whether it's an album or a book or a movie, but especially, like, in the case of Pulp Fiction, which was lightning in a bottle, I think it's so smart of him, even if he didn't mean to adapt somebody else's mm-hmm. material, because it forces you away from having to repeat yourself from scratch. And it's amazing how well Elmore Leonard's world and characters fit into Tarantino's style.
Yeah.
And if that helped influence the rest of his career by kind of seeing what Elmore Leonard did and adapting it into his own voice, then I think that we're lucky that he decided to do that. So I know that he doesn't want to, adapt anybody else's material, but some of the others anymore. But I'm glad that he did in this one case, because some of the other stuff that I heard that they were offering him at the time was like Speed, and he wasn't the right guy to do Speed, I don't think, at the time. Or like Men in Black, which is just like, it's not a good enough movie for Tarantino to do Men in Black. Like, it's Men in Black movie. Is a good movie.
Yeah, right.
But like, do you need a Men in Black directed by Tarantino?
Right.
No, that's like saying like, I want to get Oliver Stone to direct the Justice League. You don't need that. Although I would kind of want to see that.
Sure.
So, it was all about Cuba.
They use seven kinds of film stock.
And money never sleeping.
Oh, God.
So I mean, like, but that was one thing that really kind of jumped out at me in this viewing of Jackie Brown. And maybe that maturity and that kind of modesty really wasn't in any way, shape, or form a step back from Pulp Fiction, but a step forward, but just in a way that people weren't expecting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want this to turn into just a discussion on Tarantino, but I think so often I don't want to say he's dismissed. People act like he doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
That he sort of stumbles into things, or that he just steals from other places, and he's just kind of this movie brat. Writ sentient, and he puts out these movies that are just amalgamations of other stuff. But like, if you look at Inglourious Basterds and just how sophisticated that film is in terms of what it is saying, what it is about, I mean, it blows your mind. He's so much, I think, smarter than people give him credit for, and I think to, you know, suggest that Jackie Brown was some sort of just accident is a mistake. I love what you said about how it feels like a movie written by somebody who was in love at the time, because yes, I think it's the only great, you know, love story or even relationship movie that Tarantino's ever done. I think there are definitely aspects of it in some of his other movies. I think some of the stuff between like The Bride and Bebe in Kill Bill is moving. You know, there it's not that there's not any emotional content in his later films, but so many of the emotions in Kill Bill or Django Unchained or Hateful Eight or even Inglourious Basterds, which in so many ways I would say I still sometimes think is his best film, just because again of how sophisticated it is. But then I watch Jackie Brown, I'm like, how could it be anything but this?
Yeah.
They're movie emotions. They're revenge in capital letters, you know. They're not necessarily informed by anything real, whereas Jackie Brown is not about movie love.
Yeah.
It's about actual love between two adults, which we so rarely see in movies, because even when you watch some Nancy Meyer shit, like, that's movie love, you know. Every once in a while, she'll kind of touch on something that rings true. And I think that's why she stands a little bit above some of the other people making those kinds of movies. But for the most part, it's just nonsense. You know, oh, Diane Keaton, you saw me with my pants down. Ah,
like,
you know,
it's like more Crate and Barrel porn. And I like,
exactly.
And I like those movies, but it, sure. You can see the price tags hanging on.
So. Whereas Jackie Brown is just, I mean, think about how much is essentially everything in that movie is unsaid.
Yeah.
And it's like this amazing love story where two characters never acknowledge how they feel about one another.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all done in just what is not said and in their looks.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Obviously, we're going to talk about the performances, but like fucking Robert Forster.
Yeah. Max Cherry is one of my top three movie characters of all time. Him.
Absolutely.
Babe the Pig and Tony Manero.
All right.
Those are my three. Those are the three desert island things
those
that
are good
I would
picks.
Like to be.
Those are good picks. Marge Gunderson is one for me.
Yeah.
For a long time, I used to think Snake Plissken, but a couple weeks ago when I was seeing John Carpenter, they were showing clips from Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah.
And like, it's not my favorite John Carpenter movie, but Jack Burton is like the best. I mean, just clips of him, I was laughing. Like, I should have been paying attention to Carpenter playing, but I'm just laughing at Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the third one would be, but Max Cherry is an amazing pick because my God,
Max Cherry, I don't even know where to start. I mean, in the Jewish tradition, he is textbook mensch. He is the menschiest mensch there's ever been. I love so much about his performance in the sense that he's so it's like he's almost tricked himself into being, like, he thinks that he's more comfortable in his life, I think, than he thinks that he is.
Okay.
In the sense that, like, he's just gliding along in his life. He's doing his thing. He's an uber professional at being a bail bondsman. He's, you know, kind of almost decided for himself, like, this is as good as I want things to be. And then Jackie Brown comes in, and she, and it's right from when she's walking out of lockup and he sees her and that music plays and he's just looking at her. You know that just chemically he's changed. Mm-hmm. Like, he is alive for the first time in a while because of this woman. And it's got, it just comes out of the blue. It's just like, it, she hasn't even said a word to him yet, and he just knows. I think that's just kind of the love story aspect of it. It's beautiful. But also, like, there's stuff like at the, so at the end of Jackie Brown, when, you know, they kiss and she says, "You sure I can't twist your arm to come with me?" And he says, "No, but thanks for saying that." And then she leaves, and then they show, they don't cut to her driving yet. They go show him, and they fade out slowly of him walking to the back of his office.
He goes out of focus.
He goes out of focus, yeah. But you can see just enough that he puts his hand up to his head and he's thinking, and he's just like, and you don't know necessarily, like, is this going to be, and it works in two ways. Cause one, it's movie poetry of like the man and the woman who you really want to be together, but almost just don't manage to do it. But also it works in the sense that he's thinking about it, where it's like, oh my God, just fucking do it. Right. Like, just do it. But it's almost like he doesn't feel like he earns that or like he deserves that. And that's such a heartbreaking little bit of sadness to his character too. And I'm almost just like, oh God, you probably have her phone number. Like, just call her. Just be like, turn the car around. But then they show her when she's driving off, and she should be elated because she's all of the, all of her financial problems are gone.
She
got away with it. She got the ATF what they wanted. Mm-hmm. So that's tied up with a nice little bow. She's going to have a new life, but it's, she's got this glazed look on her face, and she's not belting out across 110th Street. She's just mouthing it or barely singing it. And that's what you do in the car when you've got a lot on your fucking mind and something just is really weighing on you. And that is one of the first times, I think, in the movie, just because she's so kind of wrapped up in being ahead of everybody, where you can kind of feel the heaviness of the romance with her. I think with Robert Forster, it's a lot more obvious, for me at least, that he's just smitten. Like, not in a goofy way, but he's just really smitten with her. But with Pam Grier, one of the things I'm thinking this time, and I wanted to ask you this, is just, like, where do you think she fell for him? Like, where did it happen? Because I feel like there's, like, a mutual respect thing, and love grew out of that. And also, like, he's different than a lot of the other men that she deals with in her life, where he kind of is, doesn't want to use her. He, like, is in awe of her. Like, he admires her and everything like that. And she doesn't have that with any other male character in the movie. But I was curious, like, where do you think...
Yeah, I don't know if I can pinpoint, like, the exact moment. And I don't even know if she is aware of the exact moment.
Yeah.
I think for a long time, I think she's just thinking that it's that they're in on this thing together, and she can trust him because she can tell that he's a decent person.
Yeah.
And I don't know if she's aware of how he feels about her. I mean, she goes out of her way at the end to say, "I never used you."
Yeah.
Which suggests that she did know how he felt. But I'm wondering if her feelings for him crept up on her a little bit.
Yeah. I think that's probably what happened too.
97, you know, was an especially kind of brutal year in terms of the Oscars, just because you had As Good As It Gets, Cleaning Up, and LA Confidential, and Good Will Hunting, and all these kind of heavy hitters.
No Tammy Lauren nomination. I think she got the SAG.
She got the Blockbuster Award. And that's fine. And, like, Pam Grier was nominated for Best Actress.
For not Oscar.
She wasn't?
No, she got nominated for Golden Globe and a SAG, and so did Samuel L. Jackson, but Robert Forster was the only one that got nominated for an Oscar.
That's so disgusting. For some reason, I had in my head that she was nominated. Because at the end of the movie, when she's just driving and then starts to mouth the song. I don't know. It's really hard to, like, not act, to just trust that, like, this facial expression and whatever you are feeling as an actor and however the director kind of orchestrates this moment is going to be enough.
Yeah.
But she's so good, and Robert Forster does it a lot, where, like, his expression is more or less blank. Mm-hmm. It's all in his eyes, but because of the way he's played his character, we are able to read everything into what he's feeling.
Yeah.
She's so good in that last moment. And Pam Grier, you know, is an icon and is so, like, fun to watch in a lot of those old 70s movies, but never, I don't think it's credit for, like, being a great actor. Mm-hmm. But man, in Jackie Brown, she is. And same with Robert Forster. And it's such a bummer that it didn't necessarily lead to...
Yeah, for him, he got... you know, a lot of supporting roles and some movies that, like, were theatrical, a lot of, like, video on demand type movies. But with her, like, and it was interesting because they said in the Charlie Rose interview, he was, Tarantino said, like, you know, I wrote this part for you, and but I got to warn you, like, I'm not guaranteeing what happened for John Travolta is going to happen for you.
Sure.
And she said, you know, and it's just kind of sad how she put it. She's just like, she's like, I'm a middle-aged black woman. I'm not expecting anything that a 40-year-old white John Travolta could get. And it's so true, but it's so heartbreaking, too, because if you look at her filmography, Jackie Brown is like this kind of beacon in the middle of The Escape from L.A.'s, the Mars Attacks. Then after that, she's back to The Ghost of Mars. I mean, like, they don't...
Well, I know she was, like, on The L Word for a long time, which I never watched, but I know it had a following.
Yeah.
And that's, again, if you don't love Tarantino, I don't mean to turn this into an attack on people who don't love Tarantino. That is fine. But, like, talk about a filmmaker who just loves actors and who knows actors better than anyone, because he's thinking of Robert Forster for a part at a time when... nobody was thinking of Robert Forster, like, period. Not even, like, for specific roles, just at all. People had kind of forgotten Robert Forster.
Yeah.
Nobody was writing parts for Pam Grier, you know?
Right.
But he knows exactly who should play these roles, and he's always sort of proven right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because he gets the best work that anyone's ever done in his movies, for the most part, you know?
Yeah.
You had talked about that last scene with Max Cherry where he goes out of focus, and it's so, so great. And I love how long Tarantino holds on him. Watching it the other night for the first time, when he kind of puts one arm up and then another one up by his face, for the first time I thought he might be crying.
Yeah, that's a good call.
And I don't know.
I see, it's funny because this just sort of shows how something I think has changed in me in the past year or two, in the sense that I've become a more optimistic person. I think it's,
so you're going the opposite direction from the rest of us.
I think it's a reaction to everything
okay,
else.
Okay.
I think it's, I need it in order to make my days better.
Right.
And I just sort of see the upside in certain things that not everything. I'm not an idiot, but there's a lot of stuff that, like, in movies, I kind of see differently. Like, spoilers for the end of La La Land. I'm watching the end of La La Land. And instead of the beautiful, oh, if only, now I'm just kind of like, well, they're in the same city. She could always call him up. He could always call her up, and maybe something will happen. And I'm kind of rooting for the dissolvement of her marriage. But at the same time, they had something that they didn't realize that they had, that she doesn't have with Thomas Hayden Church. What's his name?
Tom Everett Scott.
Tom Everett Scott. See? He's so... Anyways. But so there's that. And then, like, now I'm watching Jackie Brown. This is the first time where I'm just like, I don't know, maybe. Like, you never know.
Yeah.
And I maybe that's just the optimistic part of me, because I think the language of movies tells you that it's bittersweet.
Right. Well, and this movie, I think, more than any other of Tarantino's movies... does not have like a closed ending and a closed beginning. You know, a lot of his other movies, because characters die, because, hey, this mission is completed or whatever, Hitler is dead, or, you know, my daughter's back. We get sort of a pretty hard stop. And this movie feels like these are characters whose lives are going to go on. We're just dropping in on this one little section of their lives, and it's an important section, but they have lived full lives up to this, and they will continue to lead full lives. And that's, again, one of the things that I love about him as a filmmaker. And I think it's most obvious in Jackie Brown, is how much he informs the characters with lives outside of what we see.
Yeah.
Think about just how basic so many characters are in 90% of the movies that we go to see.
Mm-hmm.
And in this movie, we get Robert Forster walking back from going to see a movie by himself.
Yep.
Super small detail, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another time we see him waiting, I think he's at the mall, and he's reading a paperback.
Yeah.
You don't see that in movies because the character is like, what they're supposed to be doing is waiting. So we're going to show them waiting so that the audience knows that they're waiting.
Yeah.
It's such a little detail that's like, yeah, that's what people do. They bring the book with them. And again, it informs Max Cherry because like you're saying, he's a guy who's grown comfortable with his routine and being on his own. And yeah. So these are little signs of, well, this is what I do. This is how I've filled out my life. I read books by myself. I go to the movies by myself. Mm-hmm. I'm fine. I'm good.
Yeah.
Bridget Fonda's line about like, well, that's when I was living in Japan. Mm-hmm. Didn't need to be in the movie.
Right.
And yet it gives her entire character a history that we are not privy to.
Yeah. And it gives you enough to, I think that it gives you the credit or like the sense of fun to maybe kind of figure out some stuff for yourself. Like
one
of the things I'm wondering is, and there's like the line with Bridget Fonda where she's talking to Robert De Niro and she says, you know, like, this isn't Ordell's house. This is my house. And the whole time I'm thinking, I'm just like, well, why does she want to hang out with these people? And I'm thinking, well, she's just kind of like, she likes kind of the adventure of it. Mm-hmm. She's likes to be around criminals.
Mm-hmm.
And don't be judgmental about that. This is her choice. This is what she likes. This is, she likes to get high. She likes to be around criminals. She finds that fun or interesting. Otherwise, why would she be such a willing participant in being part of this heist and everything? It's just like little kind of things like that. And I just like, also, De Niro is so fucking good in this movie.
He's really funny.
He's really funny. And then Tarantino has like a great way. I'm thinking of also Travolta in Pulp Fiction of writing characters that might not be the right word to say if you were to say that they were stupid.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they are thoroughly uninterested in so many things.
Sure.
That they're just like glazed. And that's one thing that I like about De Niro in this. Like, he's checked out for the most part. He's the type of guy where unless you say Lewis, he's not listening.
Right, right.
Like, yeah. And there's a lot of people like that in life. I'm like that at work sometimes if I'm on the phone. I'm just like, yeah. And they just like, Adam, what do you think of this? And I'm just say something brilliant. And then I can go back to like checking Twitter for the next 2 minutes. So, and he's great at it. And also De Niro has like, I noticed this for the first time in the movie Stone, which isn't really that good of a movie, but it's interesting. It's got good performances in it.
Is that Mila Jovovich?
Yeah. And Edward Norton.
Okay.
But De Niro is so good at playing a guy who appears normal, but then starts to crack and he says, like, he does and says, like, really ugly things, or like, it's like just below the surface that he's like, trying to keep contained, or like bottle up his anger and stuff. And he has that with Lewis too. Like, he finally kind of comes to life, like, when Bridget Fonda is fucking with him in like the robbery, and then like at the, when Samuel Jackson is basically like questioning his mm-hmm. worth, like mm-hmm. afterwards, and how hurt he is. And De Niro is like great at playing like that kind of ugly part of people's emotions that sometimes I think, you know, I even forget because he's in so much like, you know, kind of bubblegum movies sometimes that are just
now especially
silly. Yeah.
At the time I remember feeling like his casting was just like Tarantino cast him because he could, like coming off Pulp Fiction, it was like, well, yeah, I can get Robert De Niro to play a part in this movie, so I'll give him this part. And I felt like
he wanted to play Max Cherry, actually.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Thank goodness he didn't. Not that he would have been bad, but like,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling like, oh, you probably could have had anybody play Lewis, you know, like mm-hmm. I don't know that needed a De Niro.
Yeah.
But it is definitely a character and a performance that I've appreciated more and more every time I watch it. And it's just one of the many reasons that you love the movie now, because mm-hmm. you just love hanging out with each of these characters, including Lewis. If I have a nitpick, and it's not even a fault of the movie, I just remember hearing Tarantino and even Bridget Fonda talk a little bit about Melanie and the way that Elmore Leonard had written her. It's like, well, she's this surfer girl who's like kind of washed up and her best days are behind her and mm-hmm. her skin is kind of sun damaged and like she's not like, I don't know. I just like, then you miscast her yeah. because I love Bridget Fonda in this movie. I love her in this movie.
Yeah.
She's great, but that is not the part that she's playing because
no, she's still prime.
I mean,
like beauty.
She's amazing.
Of,
right.
Like,
exactly.
Yeah,
so
of a surfer woman.
And
I
that
guess,
is,
so,
that
yeah.
is separate from the movie itself.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because
no,
at no point
mean.
In the movie is anyone like, well, you know, Melanie, her best days are behind her and she kind of hit the wall. Nobody ever
yeah,
says that.
No,
so
no,
it's extraneous, but I just remember hearing them talk about that. I'm like, well, then you cast the wrong person because
yeah.
you cast Bridget Fonda.
I like Michael Keaton always,
oh my God.
But in this movie, like, one thing I love about him, and it's like an unspoken thing, is so there's a line, or actually, so it's, I guess it is spoken. There's a line where Robert Forster says, you know, I think he's just a young guy enjoying being a cop.
Yes.
And it made me think, I'm just like, yeah, the thing that I love about Michael Keaton is just like, without irony, he just thinks he's the coolest
yes.
guy in the world.
Yes.
Like, just
his
leather jacket and
his
white
dick
t-shirt
at that
and stuff
time.
Like that. And the thing that I love about him, too, is just like in that post robbery interrogation mm-hmm. scene and stuff, this is not just with him, but Samuel L. Jackson has it in the van later. Like, Tarantino is really in love with scenes where people are thinking out loud.
Yes.
And I fucking love that in movies.
Or just thinking,
yes.
period. Because I remember Ebert pointing that out about Samuel Jackson's
yeah.
scene when he figures out that it was Jackie.
Yeah.
He literally just stops and is quiet.
Yes.
And then he goes, it's Jackie Brown. And
yeah.
Ebert was like, this movie allows a character time to think.
And not only that, I mean, like, Keaton is just like, trying to figure it out. He's asking
yes.
questions. He's dismissing certain things. He's like needling her and stuff like that. And it's great because it's interesting dialogue, and I like that. I like a lot of heist movies, but I wouldn't say it's a genre that I love, and a lot of it is because I feel like they're more inclined to try to be clever and put over the audience of what's really happening, and it's that's the show
mm-hmm.
that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Jackie Brown is not that at all. Like, the heist is relatively understandable. It's clever, but it's not too clever.
Right.
And
right.
And with this, you're not ever being like, well, I think they're the thing, or I think he's the one mm-hmm. doing this, or they did have a gymnast inside the safe the whole time. I mean, like, it's not any of that. Like, none of that fucking matters. Like, that's why Tarantino says it's just like, the first time you watch Jackie Brown, like, you're paying attention to the plot. After that, mm-hmm. it's the Hangout movie that I made
mm-hmm.
and stuff. So, I mean, like, I just really love it from that aspect. And also, just, oh my God, like, Samuel L. Jackson, it's my favorite performance of his in his entire career.
Yeah.
He is so great in this movie
yeah.
because he is so many different
right.
things.
Right.
He's menacing.
Right.
He's also super charming.
Right.
You can understand why Melanie would want to hang out with him all day because he's just fun.
Right.
Also, he is the thing that they didn't say this in the movie, but you could kind of infer it. But Tarantino said it in an interview, is just like, this is a guy who is a gun runner because he's a scam artist who finally found something that worked.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less dangerous for him than like selling drugs and things like that. He tried that. He tried like small time scamming. This is something where he can make a lot of money. And like, it's just also shows, and it goes back to that line where he says, you know, my ass may be dumb, but I'm no dumbass, which is like, he wants like a really modest amount of money for like this master criminal,
which I love. Like,
yeah.
$1 million is a lot of money, you know, it's
yeah.
more than you or I
but
have.
But he says, I want to use it to use the rest of my life spending,
right.
which for anybody, $1 million for the rest of your life is, you're going to have to like budget.
right. Right. but I love that it's $1 million.
Yeah.
It's not $10 million,
yeah.
not $20 million.
Yeah.
Like, it's a reasonable amount of money that's at stake here.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah.
Samuel Jackson is so good. I want to go back to just Michael Keaton real quick
sure.
because not only is he amazing in this movie, but again, credit to Tarantino for understanding actors and what's great about certain actors, because if Michael Keaton gets cast in this part in 2017, everyone goes, yeah, of course. We mm-hmm. love Michael Keaton. He's great.
Yeah.
Birdman, Spotlight. He's awesome,
mm-hmm.
right? in 1997, Michael Keaton was what? Like
Desperate Measures, Jack Frost.
Right. Like Multiplicity. Kind of on the outs, yeah. Right. Like no one was giving these kinds of parts to Michael Keaton, and Tarantino understood what's great about him as an actor and gives him this part that, yeah, he just, every single person, even Michael Bowen, who like is fine. And I like that Tarantino keeps using him. Like, he's good in the movie. It's just everyone gets their moment to shine. Chris Tucker shows up for one scene and just is
terrific.
Awesome. Yeah. Right, exactly. And they just bring these people alive. Samuel Jackson, it's fascinating because he makes a lot of movies. You know, like he is a busy, busy man.
Yeah.
And I would say 75 to 80% of the movies he makes are bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he's particularly great in them. He tends to be serviceable, if not kind of bored.
Yeah.
And then a new Tarantino movie comes out every few years, and he gets a part, and you're like, oh, right, Samuel Jackson is awesome.
Yeah, you just have to like get him interested.
Right, whether it's Hateful Eight or Django or Pulp Fiction or, most importantly, Jackie Brown, because as you said, he's so many things, and there's these scenes like where he's putting the gloves on the second time. There's a moment where he's sitting in the darkness and he's just, the whites of his eyes are lit, and it's super menacing, like you said. I mean, you get the feeling that this guy is an actual threat,
not in
movie psycho way. Like, he's just a guy who is capable of doing really bad shit.
And it's he's will be friendly with you.
Right.
Just don't fuck with him.
Right.
And like, if you, and he's paranoid, rightfully so. And if you, if he gets the idea that you are fucking with his orbit, then you are dead. Like, the consequences are going to be so much worse than like you anticipated them being.
And every character in this movie is essentially trying to outsmart every other character.
Yeah.
And they're all capable of doing it, with the exception of Lewis.
Yeah.
Everyone in this movie is smart and capable of getting one over on the other characters. It's just a question of who's going to be on top. And one of the things that I love so much about the Ray Nicolette character that you mentioned is the way that Jackie Brown essentially puts an end to all of this is not just to get Ray Nicolette to shoot Ordell. It's when she says, "You got him, Ray." That to me is like the most, it's the best moment, because that's her saying like, "You did this, you're the hero." And that feeds into exactly what he wants to hear. And that's, I think, what really puts a bow on the whole thing.
Yeah. He's definitely like,
she knows exactly what to say to him.
Yeah. He's got in his head that he's the 20 something cool, badass cop, and he will hold on to that for dear life. And this is just ammunition, no pun intended, for that. One thing,
and then
that
he shows up again in Out of Sight, which is so great.
And Out of Sight's terrific too. One thing that I love is the moment when Max and Ordell are driving back in Max's car to the bail bonds place, and they put in the tape, and it's the Delphonics, and so many things are happening in that scene. Like, Ordell says, "I didn't know you liked the Delphonics." Part of it is, I think that's when he's starting to figure out like how much Max likes Jackie.
Right.
And then also Max goes, "They're pretty good." And then Ordell gives him a look, which, I'll just put it this way. Like, I've had times where I've been in the car where I have on like hip hop or something like that, and not everybody in the car is white. And they'll kind of give me a look like, "Did you just put this on because we're in the car?" And it's never that case, but I think Ordell kind of is giving him that look like, "All right, white man."
Like, I think it's, I definitely think it, you know, the first thing he said is totally true too, that's a little character moment where he was like, "Oh boy, these two are in it. I also love that conversation too, when she first puts on the music and he's like, "What is this?" Because he goes, "Yeah, but you can't buy new stuff. You can only get new stuff on CD or something."
Yeah.
Like, what new stuff is Max Cherry listening to? What is Max Cherry listening to before Jackie Brown opens up his...
Cherry Pie by Warrant.
You think so?
Yeah.
Buckeye Cherry?
Yeah. Buck Cherry.
Buck Cherry. That's what I meant, right? Like, not Buckeye Cherry.
He's just like listening to Crazy Tonight. Bitch, but he's like, "Hey, you're Jackie Brown and you look so good. I'm on top of it." Yeah. Buck Cherry's so good.
Oh God.
Not really, but
No, not really.
Yeah, yeah. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you prefer 90s Tarantino or 2000s Tarantino?
I mean, really,
like if you had to pick out like a double feature night, like would you be drawing from which well, do you think?
I want to say 2000s only because I love Pulp Fiction, I love Reservoir Dogs, but I tend to love most of the stuff he's done in the 2000s more than those.
Yeah.
With the exception of Jackie Brown. Like, that's the one that gives me pause at all. If not for Jackie Brown, I would be like, oh, no question, 2000s.
Yeah, okay.
But Jackie Brown gives me pause because it is 90s and is... I have this thing that I always say about, like, my favorite Tarantino movie is the one I'm watching.
Mm-hmm. It's a good quote.
But Jackie Brown, man. Yeah. Like, if it's not that one, I don't know.
Yeah, this was one of those times where my order was always, like, Pulp Fiction... And then for a while it was like Jackie Brown, then Kill Bill. And then recently it's been like Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill, Jackie Brown. Mm-hmm. And now I don't even know. Now Jackie Brown might be my favorite. I mean,
and I love Kill Bill. Like Kill Bill I would often call my favorite, even though I know it's like pretty far away from being his best. I would always call my favorite because it's so many things and it pushes so many buttons that I love, you know. Where it's got action and excitement and spaghetti Western stuff and it's violent and there's emotional stuff too and great character stuff. But I mean, Jackie Brown, like even before they get to any of the heist stuff, I'm just riveted and I've seen the movie 20 times. Like Jackie Brown, you know, is in the beginning of the movie, which I love, just that long sequence of her on the little people
tarmac,
mover.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then she, just a little detail. She runs into the back, puts her stuff down, comes back out. No other movie's going to bother with that little detail.
Yeah.
She runs in the back and puts her stuff down
and
comes out and sort of presents herself. And now she's on the clock.
Yeah.
And then it fades to black, right? We don't see her again for at least a half hour. And I was like, I'm excited to get to Jackie Brown. That's fine. But I don't care because I'm just into all this Ordell shit. Like, I am fine with all of this. And, you know, one of the only times that obviously the movie is referential in terms of him taking Rum Punch and turning it into this is not a blaxploitation movie at all.
No.
But he's definitely using elements of blaxploitation, in particular the music and the casting of Pam Grier.
Yeah.
Right. But anyone saying that, like, oh, he turned this into a blaxploitation movie just has never seen a blaxploitation movie. And the music is definitely referential. But like at the same time, it doesn't really pull me out of it. It only like gives me more joy in the sequence where she's going into prison, where we're hearing Longtime Woman. So on the one hand, we're watching, you know, Pam Grier, and then we're hearing this song from The Big Dollhouse from Jack Hill. And it's also Pam Grier singing that song from The Big Dollhouse, like playing over Pam Grier in 1997. I don't know. Like, I like that shit. I understand some people don't.
Yeah.
I like that he's a filmmaker that sort of rewards you for knowing these things.
Also, like, this is the type of music that those people, if they were existing in real life, would be listening to, probably. No different than how I listen to, you know, grunge alternative still, because that's what I grew up with and I have a lot of affection for. Like, it's not hard to believe that this
Jackie
is
Brown
the type
would be
of music
better with
that,
way more Candlebox.
Yeah.
Right.
What do they sing again?
They have that slow song, right?
Oh, that helps me. What is that?
No, Far Behind, I think it's called.
Oh.
Say maybe, did not mean to treat you bad, yeah, but I did it anyway. That's what Max Cherry should have been listening to as he walked Jackie Brown pull away.
I would love if, like, Ordell just pushes in the tape and then it was like, I will treat you well, my sweet angel, so help me, Jesus. And he's like, I didn't know you liked toadies. And he's just like, they're pretty good. What are your thoughts about what we've heard so far with Tarantino's next movie? Do you have any?
I honestly have not been following it that closely.
I know that so Columbia won
that
the rights
I saw, which I just
can't
believe, like, how many places are posting that as news.
Yeah.
Just, who cares? Like,
yeah.
Here's the studio that's going to release a Tarantino movie. Okay.
I'm kind of precious sometimes a little bit with Tarantino stuff, because if he stays to what he says, which is that he's got 10 movies that he's doing and that's
sure.
when I heard that, like, I've heard now that it's about Charles Manson in the same way that, like, Inglourious Basterds is about Adolf Hitler. And that made me happy because I don't necessarily want to see a Charles Manson movie.
Well, and I can't take him at his word because when he was describing Inglourious Basterds, he's like, it's a real Dirty Dozen men on a mission story. And I'm like, no, it is not at all.
Yeah, that's true. Like, in the most base way, that's about it.
There's like two scenes of that, you know? I just will kind of wait until the movie is out and then see what it is. I don't know. I've heard Tom Cruise maybe being cast.
I heard him. I heard Margot Robbie. I've heard Leonardo DiCaprio. I've heard Brad Pitt. I'm excited. I would like Tom Cruise just because I want to see that movie.
Right.
I want to see, and it makes sense for him because he seems to only do movies with like really kind of noted directors.
Well, and especially now when he kind of needs it, you know, because he's a little bit on the
fringes of stardom,
right? But again, even if they announce the cast, I may be like, oh, I'm not into that. And then it doesn't matter, because when I see the movie, I remember being disappointed that Will Smith was not going to do Django Unchained and being disappointed that it was Jamie Foxx. Because, like, whatever, Jamie Foxx is fine. I like him. But now I see the movie, and I'm like, well, it has to be Jamie Foxx. You know, I can't imagine it being Will Smith, and especially Will Smith's quotes about why he didn't do it. I'm like, oh, fuck you, Will Smith. You don't deserve this movie. Go do Bright.
There's so much collateral beauty.
Exactly. Like, that's what you're doing, and you're turning down Django Unchained. But I loved the idea of him kind of playing against so much of his persona, and he was, you know, couldn't see it, I guess, so whatever. There's something else I wanted to say, though, about Jackie Brown, and I don't remember what it was. I feel like there was a lot of stuff I wanted to say about Jackie Brown, except that it's super awesome. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you, because Jackie Brown is the movie that was kind of the lightning rod for a lot of controversy for Quentin Tarantino. About his use of writing the N-word to put in the mouths of his characters.
Right.
And if he has the right as a white man to be doing that. I'll say this. My opinion on it is that it bothers me a lot less in Jackie Brown than it bothers me in Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. Because
That makes sense, I
guess. I feel like it's for the reasons of cool in white people's voices in those movies. Whereas his rationale that Ordell would speak this way makes more sense to me. And then also when he's used it in other movies, it's to a very specific point.
Well, Hateful Eight, right?
And Django Unchained, like, of course they would talk that
That's
way.
That's just kind of period specific, unfortunately. Yeah.
So, I mean, like, I also think that I can't answer that of how offensive it is because it's not a word used to offend me.
Right.
All I can say is that, like, when I watch, say, Inglourious Basterds, as a Jewish man, I'm not upset that he's kind of doing his own take on World War II because fuck Adolf Hitler.
Right.
Like,
right.
Why would I not be thrilled by this? Like, to see this rubber reality that I wish actually happened. Like, so I don't think that it's, and like everybody in that movie who's Jewish is portrayed as a human. Right. Like, it's not. So I mean, like, I'm happy with that. What do you think about it?
It's like you said, it's almost impossible for us to actually comment on in any real way because it's not a word that's been used against us for years and years and years. I don't know if I'm like sort of unfazed by it in Jackie Brown because I've seen it so many times and I know that it now I hear it as part of the language of that movie. Like, if I was seeing it for the first time, would it be more jarring to me now? Like, oh my gosh, they're saying that word so many times, and I'm familiar with it now enough to be like, okay. I mean, any defense of it would sound like some sort of rationale, because you're going to have people who would say, like, no, it's fine, and it's coming out of the mouth of Samuel Jackson or Pam Grier, or, you know, and they're not necessarily using it in a racist way, even though by virtue of using it, you're using racist language, right?
Yeah. I think it's a question where, like, everybody's opinion almost is valid in the sense that, like, Spike Lee was really upset by it, and I know Denzel Washington was really upset by it, and, like, dressed Tarantino down on the set of Crimson Tide while he was doing rewrites about it.
Yeah.
And I, especially at that time, I completely understand like where they're coming from.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just one of those situations where, I mean, like, if you're offended by it, then you're on the right track. Like,
right, of course. Yeah. There are other movies that would just use it once.
Yeah.
So yesterday I was rewatching The Man with Two Brains, mm-hmm. which is a really funny movie.
Yeah.
And 2/3 of the way through the movie, Kathleen Turner, who has been portrayed as an awful person for mm-hmm. the entire movie, is yelling at Steve Martin and throws that word out.
Yeah.
Along with a bad word for Jewish people and a bad word for Italians.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the joke is, oh, she's so awful, she just crams these three yeah. terrible words together.
Mm-hmm.
Get it? She's awful. And that, to me, was so much more jarring, even though, you know, again, that movie was from 1982.
Yeah.
That was so much more jarring to me than anything in Jackie Brown.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's just about context. But again, anything I say is like, I'm coming at it from a position of not having that word used against me ever. So
right.
for me to be like, it's fine, is bullshit because it invalidates people who don't ever want to hear it. But, you know, it's a weird thing because there seem to be two camps, which is one camp saying, and by the way, if you're in the camp of white people saying it's fine to use that word, you don't get a camp. Like, yeah. this is not what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm talking about two camps within sort of the African-American community. One camp saying, like, no, it's our word and we can say it how we want. And then the other camp saying, like, it should never be spoken again. Mm-hmm. And who am I to say, you know, what side is right?
Right. Yeah. And I think we kind of have to address, too, like, just sort of this whole... I mean, it's hard to watch a Miramax movie from this time period and not wonder about everything that was going on.
Yeah.
And like you see, it's even to the point where you see Bridget Fonda and you're kind of like, where did she go after some of this time? And then now you're kind of like, what happened? And I hope it didn't happen with her and things like that. And I was able to put that aside while I was watching Jackie Brown pretty quickly, which I don't even know what the right word is. It's not like right to say I was relieved by that. I mean, the whole thing where Tarantino came out in that New York Times interview and said, you know, like, I knew enough to know that
I should have done more.
That I should have done more. And I mean, it's so upsetting to hear that. And then at the same time as... Just as I just want to focus almost like on as a movie fan, mm-hmm. as like a viewer,
mm-hmm.
like what do you do when you're, say, for me, one of my favorite movies of the year is Baby Driver, but now I want nothing to do with Baby Driver for a long time.
Sure.
And it's like, but then you're punishing a lot of other people. And then it's like, if I watch it and I use it under the rationale of, you know, like, why punish myself? Because I didn't do anything wrong. It's just like, and then there's the counter argument. It's like, yeah, but you're still supporting that person in that way, kind of subliminally by watching their movie. Or if I'm like, I remember like just fucking a week ago, like I'm like, oh, let's review Murder on the Orient Express. But then there's Johnny Depp who beat up his wife, or Daddy's Home 2 with racist Mel Gibson. Or like if I'm watching, you know, Lady Bird and there's a preview for the next Woody Allen movie, or like, it's just kind of like, if you drew a lot, I heard it best on another podcast, is on the Movie Madness podcast that Eric Childress was hosting, and Sergio Mims said, if you drew a line in the sand and said, I'm never going to watch another movie with a person who's done something bad, you would never see another movie for the rest of your life.
Sure.
And I just am fatigued with having to consider my humanity in the case of like, should I watch this movie or be a fan of this movie? And it's really uncomfortable and offensive and sad. And the whole Harvey Weinstein thing with Tarantino, and not to make excuses for him, but when you hear some of the stuff like about how he has like ex-Mossad agents stalking people and stuff, I mean, I don't know, like maybe he was afraid to say something because of that. Does that make it right? Does that make it wrong? It's just like such a fucked situation.
Well, his quote was frustrating. And, you know, we got into this a little bit last week on the Blade Runner podcast. And, and some people were very supportive of that and said, hey, it's good to hear you guys talk about that. And other people were like not happy because we didn't bring up Johnny Depp or like you're always going to find people who feel like, well, you didn't talk about it in the right way.
Yeah.
And it's like. And that's the problem is like we're all finding our way during all of this. And Tarantino got a lot of pushback for his quote. And, you know, in some ways, rightfully so. Mm-hmm. If he knew enough, he should have done something. At the same time, when I heard the quote, and this isn't you know, am I blinded by being a fan of him as a filmmaker? Am I trying to justify something? I don't know. But I appreciated that what he said, while I think wrong in that, yes, you should have done more, seemed honest to me.
Yeah.
Because so many of these statements coming out, oh, I didn't know anything and I'm disgusted by this. And
or like, we need to be part of the solution now when like you were fucking part of the problem.
It's right. Like, yeah. And so many movie stars are coming out to condemn Harvey Weinstein who worked with him time and again. And and maybe truly did know nothing. Mm-hmm. But I guess I just appreciated that Tarantino, while in the wrong in this case, said, hey, I knew more than I knew enough to know that I should have done more. It's honest, and I just think that that's the only way that we can start moving forward, is if we're at least honest about certain things.
Yeah.
To just pretend like, what? I never knew about this. I was blind to it all, and I'm as disgusted as you guys. If that is not true, it's total bullshit, and it helps no one. It just absolves you of guilt, right? So it's... We're in just a weird place because every day new things are coming forward about more and more people. And, you know, to your point about Baby Driver,
like that was my number one favorite movie this year. And now like I see Lady Bird and I'm like, thank God there's something to replace it, because sure, Baby Driver might still be on my 10 favorite movies of the year list and everything. I'm sure it will, but it's just like, I didn't want it to be like, I feel like the only pick on your list basically that mean anything are like, one is your number 10. I always am fascinated by people's number 10s. And the other one is your favorite movie of the year.
Okay.
It's like, because that's the movie that spoke to you.
Right.
Like, it's not just, oh, I thought it was really well made. It's like that had to speak to you in a way.
Right.
When I had that with Lady Bird, I was just like, thank God this is the movie that represents my pie in the sky of 2017.
Well, listen, even before we knew he was a disgusting sex predator, Kevin Spacey's character was always a problem in that movie.
Yeah.
So, no. But here's kind of how I see it. And everybody's going to be different. Like, you know, everybody has a different line. Everybody has a different, will nobody watch a Roman Polanski movie? Will nobody watch a Woody Allen? It's a conversation we've been having for years and years and years. I think a lot of us need time away from some of these people, like Kevin Spacey. You're not going to put on Baby Driver because it's like, it's so fresh you can't divorce it, right? But I think part of it too is, you know, we are just in the position of just being movie fans. We are not industry insiders. We weren't on the set of Baby Driver. We've never hung out with Kevin Spacey. So there may be people who are mad that Kevin Spacey even got that movie because, gosh, he was a known predator for years, right? And that may be true in Hollywood. That is not true out here in Chicago, hundreds of miles away from Hollywood. We don't know anything about Kevin Spacey except his next movie.
Yeah.
So we have never known him to be a sex predator until it was announced, hey, this guy has been a sex predator for years. So I don't think – and again, I don't want to see him for a while, but does that mean that – in a year, I'm not going to watch LA Confidential? You know what? I probably will.
Yeah.
I think the difference is once you know who this person is, once they've sort of been revealed, do you continue to support their new work? And that's the thing about the Mel Gibson shit that makes me so mad is like, not only is he given big parts in big Hollywood
he's like nominated
comedies,
for best
he was
director.
Fucking nominated for best director at the Oscars, this thing that they want us to take seriously.
Yeah.
That to me, if Kevin Spacey a year or two from now starts getting parts again, even if it's a movie you want to see, then I think you have a real question of like, I want to see that movie, but I refuse to support that. And I disagree with the people who are underwriting his behavior now. That's a different debate.
It's so complex. I mean, like, I think you almost just take it on like a movie to movie basis. Yeah. It's just like, what do you feel at that moment to do? Although I do feel, I really just hope that things don't revert to the status quo with this situation. I don't know how it could, but I mean, like, it's really weird what's happening in the world nowadays. But it makes me really, in a way, embarrassed somewhat to have continued to watch, say, like a Roman Polanski or Woody Allen's movies. It's like, why didn't this bother me more? Mm-hmm. Like, why did I just kind of, because every year I would see the new Woody Allen movie and I would joke about his filmmaking and how staid and kind of old fashioned it is, but it was never anything more than that. Mm-hmm. And I could just talk about it like it was a normal movie, and it's just kind of like, thank you. I'm glad I had this wake-up call, yeah, in a way. I don't know. Like, I'm really happy that you kind of said, you know, it's a confusing time and we're all kind of just sort of figuring it out. Because, sure, yeah, there's really no right answer one way or the other.
Right. And do your best. You know, everyone can only do their best to figure it out for themselves and to help other people figure it out. But telling people, like, the way that you're figuring it out is wrong, the way you're talking about it is wrong, is probably not productive, you know.
Right. Yeah.
I'm enough of a pessimist that right now I worry that things are going to go back to the way they were, mm-hmm, because we have such a short memory. Because we really are experiencing, I think, a massive change in the country right now, and in terms of movie making, I'm talking about, you know, yeah, I mean, in the country as well. But I've just seen so much happen in the last 2 years, mm-hmm, where we know so much now that should guide our choices, and it doesn't change, like,
yeah,
the choices that we make. And so knowing all of this that's going on in Hollywood, knowing how many of these people are scumbags, should 100% change who's getting work. More work should be offered to women. Mm-hmm. More female filmmakers should be given opportunities, not just because Wonder Woman, mm-hmm, made a bunch of money, not just because Lady Bird is great, but, yeah, also because you see what problems there are in the system that lead to this kind of a thing, right? But until, unfortunately, the people making those decisions are willing to make those changes, I worry that, like, we're just going to keep hiring the same,
yeah,
30 white guys. I don't know. God, I hope not.
Yeah, I hope not too. But, yeah, so this was the most serious Adam Risky episode.
It was. But these are conversations that need to be had.
No, I know. I feel it's shitty for diffusing it with a joke there.
No,
but, like,
it's fine.
It's totally something that, like, you have to talk about when you're probably, because you and I had talked about doing a show on Jackie Brown for a long time,
yeah,
before this.
Yeah.
But the story from A to Z has changed,
right,
on that movie since then.
Right. And, you know, we are a little podcast that, like, I don't know how many people listen to. It's not that many, mm-hmm, you know, like, more than I would have hoped for, but we're not one of the big people. And I still feel some obligation to talk about this. And so I feel very frustrated when I see another website, which is literally ground zero for a lot of this shit,
mm-hmm,
posting like, hey, we know we haven't said anything about this. We're still figuring it out.
Yeah.
And listen, you want to post that, that's fine. What I don't understand is hundreds of comments underneath that say, oh my God, thank you guys for saying that. Thank you for your transparency and your honesty. I'm like, what are you fucking complimenting?
Yeah.
That they haven't said anything and are continuing to say nothing? Like, yeah, how is that helpful?
You, just my opinion, you might not be the perpetrator of a crime, but when your back's against the wall by circumstance, it says a lot about your character on how you react. And I know who you're talking about. I'm not going to name them, but, like, that reaction makes me think that this thing shouldn't exist anymore. It's a symbol of something that is toxic and it would be better done without.
And I can't for the life of me figure out the hundreds of people who I'm not saying don't support them, whatever, but like who compliment
it's because they want things to get back to normal.
But what is normal? Do you know what I mean? Like they, the way things want, were 6 months
that's
ago?
What because they want. That's what they want.
Like, look at what we're finding out. Look at what was happening 6 months
there's
ago.
There's another site where their creator was sexually harassing women and they went away and like they posted to their credit updates on kind of what was going on and they had frank conversations on video of like, you know, we're shocked and we detest what happened and please stick with us and keep in mind we're not giving you original content right now or going back to the status quo because it's not right to do that. And they got back to it, to what they were doing, which they should get back to what they're doing because they addressed their situation
right.
both with action and emotionally as people. But yeah, I think that a lot of, and it's, I'm not, I mean, there's a section of, you know, movie fandom or geek fandom, what have you, that just has the blinders on.
Yeah.
They just don't see outside of their interests.
Right.
And it's really disappointing.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's it, huh? That's how we're wrapping this one up.
I'll end with me and Rob are going to have a reserve seating Al Pacino review on Two for the Money. And I told Patrick this before we rolled, but there's a line in Two for the Money where Al Pacino gives Matthew McConaughey credit for a 9-2 weekend in picking pro football games correctly. And he just goes, "You're a mutant." And the whole time, I'm just like, why was Al Pacino never Professor Xavier?
He needed to be Professor X. Yeah.
He's just like, oh my God, she can run through a wall. Through a wall.
Plug me in to Cerebro. You're a mutant. Give me all the mutants you got. Give me all you got. So you're an empath, huh? What am I feeling right now? I mean, it wouldn't be a show with the two of us if we just didn't get into some goofy voice at some point. This has otherwise been a pretty serious show.
Yeah.
No joke, though. Like, I want to watch Jackie Brown again right now. I watched it 2 nights ago. Throwing up. I had just eaten, like, I don't like Papa John's, right? My kid likes Papa John's. So we had ordered Papa John's.
Part of the problem.
Exactly. So after throwing up, I never want to eat Papa John's again.
Sure.
Because not only do I not like it, but now I will forever associate it with how it tasted coming back up. Jackie Brown, I could watch tonight. And like, well, how come I don't associate that with puking all night? Because it's great, everyone. Yeah. Because it's great.
So to give you something nice to end on besides puking, Patrick puking, Patrick and I will be back next month. We are doing our annual holiday episode, and I'll give you a tease of what it is. It is a Notorious Christmas movie with someone
also,
who...
Also celebrating an anniversary.
Celebrating an anniversary, and it's from a person who once a year at very least always delivers. You'll just have to wait and see who that is. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.